Welcome to Careers in Your Ears, the careers podcast for PhDs and research staff at King's College London. I'm Vicky Tipton, one of the careers consultants working with researchers here at King's. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Bethan Cornell, a King's PhD student in the physics department and also a policy officer working in the Department of Education's Higher Education Unit. Bethan, a very warm welcome to you and huge thanks for joining us. I'd love to start by asking you, if I can, to tell us about why you decided to do a PhD in the first place.
Sure, thanks so much for having me as well. I think I wanted to do a PhD largely, I think, because I didn't really have a handle on where I wanted my life to go. And I knew that I loved physics and I loved solving problems. And it made sense to keep doing that since I knew I enjoyed it for a bit. And then I thought, well, I'll figure out everything else along the way. So that's kind of why I went into it in the first place, really.
That's great. Thank you. And I suppose just out of interest, we'd love to know a little bit more about your PhD research. Could you tell us more about it, please?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm based in the physics department, but we have quite a large biological physics section, and we're really interested in why basically some cells go really gloopy and viscous, and they're sometimes associated with diseases like Alzheimer's disease or cancer. And we don't really understand why, for example, an Alzheimer's patient will have gloopy brain cells. Is that to do with the Alzheimer's disease, or is it in the other way around, cause and effect? But before we go on and answer all of those big biological questions, we need a really good way of measuring cellular viscosity. So understanding why, you know, how much something is more gloopy than something else that's nice and healthy and fluid. And in order to do that, we need really good tools. So you need a good toolkit if you're going to go and measure anything. And our group basically aims to understand and develop these little molecular probes that go in and sense cell viscosity. So in my PhD, I'm using my understanding of physics and light, because these little probes give off light, so they're really, really bright when a cell is really viscous and they're dark when they're fluid. And I try and understand through my understanding of physics and light how these little cells interact with their environment around them, how we can change our tools and make them more sensitive so that the biologist can go on and get better results in the future. I don't know if that made any sense, but
it did make complete sense. I'm no physicist, no scientist at all, but I was able to follow all of that very, very easily. So thank you so much for explaining that. It sounds so interesting and such a nice example for me of how physics works with other sciences to sort of research specific problems. I think it sounds really exciting. And I suppose by contrast, the role that you're doing at the moment is with the Department for Education. Yeah. And I'd love to hear a little bit about the day-to-day work that you're doing there at the moment as well. Yeah.
Sure. So I work in the Higher Education Directorate within DfE. So DfE is responsible for all of the sort of government's education policy across the board, and that includes universities, but mainly the teaching side. And there's another department that focuses on sort of research policy. And I'm the policy lead for student consumer rights, complaints and harassment within higher education. So student consumer rights covers all sorts of things like tuition fees, people, you know, if people are buying an education, are they being respected as a consumer? And then complaints, obviously, if people have a complaint, we work really closely with the Office for Students and the independent adjudicator to make sure that complaints handling happens really well across the board. And linked into that, it sounds quite separate, but obviously if people are experiencing harassment with higher education, then they want to make complaints about it normally. So that's kind of the link. Is I also lead on the government's strategy for tackling harassment and hate crime within higher education. So you may have seen on the news quite recently, there's been a lot of stories around sexual harassment within higher education and also anti-Semitism, but we do cover more broad themes, racism, different types of xenophobia as well. And really our goal is just to work with various different stakeholders and within higher education, providers, Universities UK, the Office for Students, just to make sure that students have a really welcoming and fulfilling experience within higher education.
How interesting that you're both a consumer of higher education, yeah, but also working, yeah, right at the other end, the kind of macro scale of things, looking at it from that point of view.
Yeah, I actually think I'm in quite a privileged position in a way, because obviously today is a PhD day for me, so I'm wearing my consumer hat where I am a student, and you know, I'm may experience all of these things that I work on the policy for. But then when I jump over to DfE, so I work at DfE part-time, tomorrow is a DfE day for me, I'll then be thinking about it from very much the government policy perspective. And I do think I'm very lucky having one foot in each camp, because when I'm then making, you know, helping to make policy decisions or, you know, advise ministers on policies, I've got some real world experience that I can tap into that I hope helps. And there's a lot of people within my team that have a lot of, you know, years experience working within the sector. And it's, I think it's important that, you know, if you're working within something like higher education, you've at least got some experience of it, because it makes you hopefully better at your job.
You started your PhD full time. Could you tell us then about the journey from being a full time PhD to now, where you're a part time final year PhD student and also working for the Department for Education?
Yeah, sure. So when I started my PhD, I think I was obviously just wanting to do research, and I was really, you know, throwing myself into my project. But I've also always been interested in all the other things you can do as a scientist. So outreach work, science communication, inspiring others to get into it if they've got a passion for it. And I got some experience as a STEM ambassador and organising Pint of Science events. And I started getting into mentoring because, obviously, as you know, physics is quite male dominated. And I knew as a female physicist, well, physics is for everyone. In fact, I just saw myself as a physicist. To me, my gender wasn't important. But I'd look around and think, well, why aren't other girls taking this up? And so during all these experiences doing mentoring, and I worked with the Institute of Physics on a few projects to try and get more girls into STEM, I started to get really energized about these kind of issues, about why certain groups weren't getting equal access to higher education and research opportunities. And alongside my PhD developing, you know, my thinking around my research, I also started to develop my sort of opinions around higher education and what maybe could be done better to improve the good system that we've already got. And as part of that, I became aware of the Higher Education Policy Institute, or HEPI as they're more commonly known. And they're the UK's only independent think tank devoted to higher education issues. And they do lots of reports every year about the student experience, and they write blogs, and I've become engaged with their work. And I just wrote to them and sort of said, hi, I'm a PhD student. I'm really energized by this stuff. I really like your content. Can we chat? And I got chatting with them, and I got really lucky. They were looking for an intern, and right place, right time. I got offered a 4-month internship during my PhD. And this happened to be during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I paused my PhD and worked with HEPI for 4 months, and I wrote a few reports, one about being a PhD student. And because the COVID pandemic was kicking off, DfE were starting to get quite short staffed, because obviously they had to mobilize a lot of people to try and solve a lot of the big issues that were coming up around you know, delivering higher education within a massive pandemic. And they know HEPI very well. They reached out to HEPI and said, did you know anyone who might be interested in working for us? HEPI said, yeah, we've got this intern who's just about to finish. I'll ask her. And they put me in touch, and DfE offered me a job. So I thought, having had the experience of working at HEPI, I thought, it's not something I want to stop. I'm still really interested in this policy stuff, so I'll give it a go. And I went down to part-time with my PhD, and here we are. I think it's a bit random, but it's worked out okay.
Yeah, that's how you got there. And I mean, it's quite unique, isn't it, to be sort of doing the PhD part-time and to be working in this way part-time, but such a great opportunity. And actually, in that story, what I'd love to understand a little bit more about is the moment when you reached out to HEPI, to the Higher Education Policy Institute. Was it as simple as sending them an email? Did you just reach out and say, hi, I'm a PhD student? What happened next? Tell me a bit more about that process. Did you say, can I get some work experience to them, for example?
No, I didn't. And to be honest, I don't think I was looking for work experience, which I think probably helped me get work experience in the end in a weird way. I think because I genuinely was just interested in what they did, and I could see, so their daily blog has a lot of guest writers, and the way they work is, and you can tell this from just from a quick Google at their website, they have a very small team, but they reach out to other people who do a lot of their big reports. They try and bring together voices in the sector, they hold events, and I knew that was the way they work just from a quick look at their website. And I thought, well, if they're engaging with other people, why can't they engage with me? I've got some opinions. I'd love to chat with them, basically. And I think because they could tell that I was reaching out because I was genuinely interested, as opposed to I'm applying for loads of things and I'm just looking for work. I think that was why it worked really well, because we were a great fit. I was obviously engaged with their work, and it was only after a conversation with director Nick that I'd sort of even thought about the idea of an internship. I totally wasn't expecting to be offered something, and I don't think he was expecting to find somebody that was the right fit. But sometimes right place, right time, and if you follow your instincts and, you know, you follow the things that you're passionate about, I feel like, what was it they always say, if you, the harder you work, the luckier you get sometimes. And I think it was a really good example of that with me.
So literally you were following your interests. The objective for you was to have a conversation with them.
Yeah, totally. And I think I'm very aware of how, you know, probably 90 times out of 100, that's not going to work. And I was the very lucky 10% of times where it happened to coincide with, you know, everything working out in my favour. But I do think even if I hadn't been offered a job, I still did the right thing and I wouldn't have changed anything, because I wasn't looking for a job. I just wanted to explore these kind of interests that I was having in a more professional capacity, I think.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, it's very serendipitous that it happened so quickly after you contacted them that they had an internship available. But it's just a really nice example of how reaching out to people who share your interests professionally and, you know, personally can have value in terms of just having got that conversation, but other things further down the line as well.
And I think it wasn't as straightforward as just we met and they offered me a job. It was a kind of 6 month relationship building period. So they invited me. I think the way it worked was I met Nick for lunch in Oxford, where their offices are, and we had a chat generally. And then he suggested that I write some pieces, which I did. And they have regular events, and he said, "Well, come along, and you know, you can help out as a member of the team at some of our events and get to know us a bit better," which I did. And one of the pieces that I originally thought I was going to write up into a blog was about PhD student mental health. And when I started doing the research for it, I realised it was quite a bit more substantial. And I sort of said to him, "Well, I think this would really suit a much longer report." And then when he started thinking about me writing a report, he sort of thought, "Well, we've got this internship opportunity. Why don't you do it as an internship and you can do other stuff as well?" So it wasn't quite as straightforward as you reached out to us, here's a job. But we did have to build a relationship. But I think, you know, it probably, from first sending an email to Nick to starting my internship, was probably about 9 months, I think. But the time flew by because I've been engaging with them throughout. So it was a natural sort of stepping stone, I think.
Yeah. So just through the course of engaging and sharing those interests and developing through those little small examples that you've given, it's a really nice example of networking and relationship building. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. So I suppose now what I really want to ask is, you know, apart from the fact that you are, you know, a PhD student in physics, and there's obviously a relationship there between the context that you're working in, the knowledge that you're gaining about higher education, and that fits with the role, I would say that the two jobs, being a physics researcher and a policy officer, sound absolutely worlds apart. So I'd love to hear what your thoughts on that are, and also what sort of skills, experience, and maybe attributes you've brought from that PhD experience into your current role.
Yeah, I think most people that I speak to think that they're probably worlds apart. But one of the things I'm really passionate about communicating is the value of doing a science degree, particularly a maths-based science degree. So, you know, as a physicist, I would say that I, you know, throughout my studies, right from undergraduate level to now, physics for me is not about learning facts or learning, you know, things that happen that I can write down and recite. In fact, I can recite very little. I probably can't remember anything from my PhD. But what I can do is work things out from scratch, because a physics degree is all about learning how to process information and solve complex problems given information. And obviously you need a few basic tools to do that. You need to know a few things, but it's very much, you know, the physics PhD experience, and I mean, presumably a lot of other PhDs, obviously can't speak because I haven't done one in another discipline, but, you know, certainly the research experience building on from that undergraduate physics degree is all about, okay, I've got this question, right, I need to go and find some evidence, and then I need to piece that evidence together and come up with a logical conclusion as to what the answer to my question is. And I might then go off on tangents and explore other things that I didn't know about, and I can go and research those. And that is exactly word for word how I would describe policymaking. So when we do policymaking, we have a policy question, we go and find some evidence, and then we piece the evidence together to come up with a policy solution. And so while, okay, I'm not looking at electrons when I work for DfE, and I'm not looking at student consumer rights when I write my thesis, the process is exactly the same. And I would say the skill set is very, very similar. So there is a lot of crossover. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why some people can maybe be put off doing a physics degree, because it sounds super niche, you know, electrons, particles, space, astrophysics. But actually, a physics degree is just a degree in solving problems and coming up with solutions. So it's very similar to policy, I think.
Great, thank you. That's such a helpful explanation, and really brings them together, those worlds, rather than seeing them as set apart. So in addition to the kind of, I guess, the knowledge and the skills that your research degree has given you directly, do you think there are any other experiences that you've had as a PhD which have helped you to move to this point? You mentioned a couple of things earlier on that you've done, but I'm just interested to know what else it is that you think has helped you move in this direction.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've really loved during my PhD, which I've been annoyed couldn't happen recently, is being able to travel. So I've traveled abroad to sort of intensive sort of summer schools, learning different bits and bobs for, you know, techniques that I can use in my PhD, but also to conferences. And I was very fortunate, the Thomas Young Centre, which is a centre based with the London universities looking at sort of molecular problems. They funded me to go and work in France for 3 weeks a couple of summers ago now. So I work with a collaborator out there. And I think those experiences of seeing research from different cultural points of views and, you know, research within a different country and another institution have allowed me to sort of form comparisons about my own experience and reflect on my own experience within higher education in the UK. And I think that's probably some of the reason why I started to get interested in what does it mean to be a good researcher? What does it mean for students to have a successful experience within education? And what are other people doing? What's going on in other countries? In fact, one of the forums at King's that I really benefited from was the Royster Global Fellowship Programme. So there's a group in the University of North Carolina who are the Royster Global Fellows. They're PhD students who are funded centrally from different disciplines, and as part of their PhD program they come together regularly to solve cross-disciplinary problems. And King's has a sort of sister group. We don't meet quite as regularly, but we go to the Royster annual conference, and I went to the first one was at King's, and then in my second year I was able to go out to UNC. And the themes are very broad. So the first theme that we talked about was the civic university, and the second theme was borders. And I loved coming together with people at a similar stage of life, all PhD students, and comparing experiences and expertise to solve really broad, complex problems. And I thought it was a wonderful experience, not only in terms of, you know, academically to think about things from a different perspective and to realize that a niche interest could be put into a bigger picture and solve something huge, but also sort of culturally it was really great to meet new people, gain confidence of, you know, speaking in front of people, not being scared to ask questions. And I think all of those experiences really helped form where I've got today.
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And my final question for you today is, what advice might you have for PhDs or other researchers to help them to engage with their own career thinking?
I'd say probably the biggest piece of advice I can get is make the PhD your own. So there's, I think, when you're in a very pressured environment, you know, in a lab where you're surrounded by people who really want to go into research, it can be, you know, sometimes it can be seen as a failure not going into research. And sometimes you can get really pigeonholed down this, you must publish papers, you know, papers is really important, go to conferences, like you've got to work crazy hours and you must just do your PhD. And actually, although that's one narrative and it's totally a valid one, if you want to become a successful researcher, you know, your PhD is a really unique opportunity to manage your own time and manage your own sort of passions and interests before you have, you know, before you've got to make any sort of firm decisions. And I think really value the 4 years or 3 years that you've got to explore who you want to be as a person, what your skills and attributes are. And if you can make the most of your PhD in that respect and throw yourself into all the opportunities you're given, whether that's academically going to as many conferences as you can, writing as many papers as you can, or whether it's, you know, engaging with all the opportunities that are to offer at King's, then I think that will naturally lead you down to a path that's hopefully right for you. Don't be scared to be a bit different. You know, at the end of the day, you obviously got to get your thesis written, but as long as you can get your thesis written, then don't be scared to explore other opportunities, I think.
That's great advice and a great place, I think, to leave today's episode. It's been great to talk with you, Bethan, and I wish you sort of every luck with your new career as it's kind of coming towards the end of your PhD and you're sort of in the world of higher education policy. So hope it goes really well for you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And do join us again for more episodes of Careers in Your Ears, where we'll be continuing our exploration of researchers' careers.